You're listening to event audio from the Brookings Events Podcast, part of the Brookings Podcast Network. For more in-depth analysis and commentary from Brookings scholars and our guests, go to brookings.edu/podcasts or listen via Apple Podcasts, on Spotify, or your favorite podcast app. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter at Policy Podcasts.
Good afternoon. I'm pleased to welcome you to this event, Taking the Pulse of the COVID-19 Economy, New Census Bureau Weekly Surveys, sponsored by the Hutchins Center on Fiscal and Monetary Policy at Brookings. We're very happy to have with us today staff from the Census Bureau, Ron Jarman, Nick Orsini, and Victoria Velkoff, who are going to describe new surveys the Census has designed and implemented so that we can better understand in real time the impact that the COVID-19 pandemic is having on our economy. When they're done discussing the new data, they'll join us in a panel discussion moderated by our own David Wessel, director of the Hutchins Center. Also joining that discussion will be Daniel Goroff, vice president and program officer of the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, who has been a valued partner to the economic studies program over the years. Before turning over the mic to our census guests, I just want to express how pleased I am that we are hosting this event. The country is in the midst of an economic calamity, the likes of which we have not seen since the Great Depression. In order for the public and policymakers to make decisions, they need accurate, trusted, and up-to-date information. However, many traditional statistics are only available with a lag of a month or typically much more, and they aren't tailored to the special circumstances of the pandemic. So these surveys will fill a much needed gap. The new surveys are also a powerful symbol of the way that our government and our public servants are working quickly and creatively to ensure that the public and policymakers have the information needed to understand what is going on in order to make the best decisions possible. So I want to express my profound thanks to everyone at the Census who made this possible. With that said, I'm happy to introduce Ron Jarman, Deputy Director and Chief Operating Officer of the U.S. Census Bureau, who is going to start us off with an overview of the project. Ron?
Thank you, Stephanie. And I too, want to echo your appreciation for the hardworking staff of the Census Bureau that's done just yeoman's work putting these surveys together while we were also replanning the fieldwork for the 2020 Census. You know, I would get in trouble with some of my colleagues back at the Bureau if I didn't mention that we are doing the 2020 census. My Bayesian prior is that most of the people watching this have probably filled out their census, but just in case you haven't, I would really appreciate you going on 2020census.gov and filling that out for us. But so, you know, these surveys are a great example of how we are trying to you know, make the Census Bureau more modern, more nimble, more responsive to our data users. And typically during a disaster or crisis situation, you know, we roll out a bunch of data that's relevant to the crisis. But like you said, Stephanie, often those things are based on source data that are dated, sometimes with a substantial lag. And that's true whether they come from surveys that we conduct or whether they come from administrative sources. You know, those have a particular lag as well. We are looking at a lot of research into more timely, more granular data sources, especially for things like the retail sector, where we can get, point of sale data or credit card data. Those are still in a very experimental phase, and we're using those in some of our economic indicator programs. But they're just not ready to cope with the data needs of the country in a crisis like the one we have right now. So I think when we looked at this, we had our options were some very timely administrative data that we do get from the Internal Revenue Service on filings for employer identification numbers, and Nick's going to talk about those after he describes the Small Business Pulse survey. With our business formation statistics, and we're able to take those data with a combination of a modeling and what have you to produce some weekly information from administrative data. But for the most part, most of the things that people wanted to know about in the current COVID-19 crisis, we really needed to go to a survey platform to do that, to get timely and granular data. So you know, I think we're really fortunate that we were able to find, you know, the resources to do this. It's been a lot of work over the past weeks, and we're very excited to share the information with data users. We really do think that this is going to help, you know, both the public, but especially, you know, the folks who are responsible for responding to and helping the country recover from the crisis. So with that, I'll turn it over to Nick Orsini, who's going to talk about our Small Business Pulse Survey, and then we'll hear from Tori Velkoff after that. So thank you.
Very good. So I'm going to talk a little bit about the Small Business Pulse Survey. I'll just jump right in here and provide an overview. So the Small Business Pulse Survey is a high-frequency weekly survey intended to collect information on the challenges small business are facing in the face of COVID-19. It consists of about 16 questions and takes about 5 minutes to complete. Over the course of 9 weeks, we will reach 900,000 businesses, and the collection period will begin on April 26th, and it will complete on June 27th. Okay. Results will be released as experimental data products. The goal of the survey is to provide some timely real-time information on the impacts of COVID-19 and demonstrate the Census Bureau's ability to be agile in responding to situations such as this. We estimate that it took 32 days to get from the conceptual development of this survey to the field, which is somewhat remarkable for public sector surveys. I'll talk a little bit about the methodology. The target population for this survey is single location employer businesses with receipts of less than $1,000 and with less than 500 employees. We needed to turn this around relatively quickly, so we used a new concept in order to reach respondents through email only. This definitely reduced the expense in reaching our respondents, and it was somewhat necessary in the face of our national processing center being closed. Okay, some of the content. We opened the survey with a question on overall well-being. It's an open-ended question. We designed it that way, and we're looking to hear overall, not just specifically in the financial area or based on revenues. We want to get a conceptual overall well-being that the businesses are facing. Then we start with touching on operations. We ask three questions on challenges. Then we get into some financial questions. And then we end the survey with a question on outlook and the business's outlook on returning to normal operations. We ask one identifying question. We ask businesses to provide us with their EIN, which we could later use to link to other data sources in the Census Bureau, and we could also use it to verify the respondent. Where do we find results? So this is the website of where we are putting all the results from the survey. We have a tool for the Small Business Pulse Surveys that allows you to make fast and easy comparisons between sectors and states. We see how the pandemic has a differential impact. Time series charts will be available Thursday, May 21st, that's tomorrow, when we publish weeks 2 and 3. Right now we have week 1 available. Tomorrow we will publish weeks 2 and 3 to get caught up. And then every Thursday afterwards, we will publish the prior week's data. Okay, let's get into some results here. So on the survey, we have an open-ended remarks area where businesses could tell us what they're feeling. So In the first 3 weeks, we've collected over 8,000 remarks each week from businesses. This kind of verified the fact that businesses are eager to tell us how they're feeling. And just from a simple keyword aggregation, you could see what rises to the top of businesses' concerns here. And, you know, we have PPP, loans, closed, rent, things mainly dealing with finance rising to the top. Let's get into some of the questions here. Question one asks, overall, how has this business been affected by the COVID-19 pandemic? And, you know, as we somewhat expect it, there is a huge negative impact. So if you look at the first two categories, almost 90% of businesses noted a negative impact, something we kind of expected. We dive into question one a little bit more. These negative impacts are being seen in food and accommodations, which is NAICS 72. I'm not sure if you could see that on the screen, but it's over to the right. Also in the education services, health services, and art and recreation, we see larger negative impacts. I'll skip to question four. Question four asks, in the last week, did this business temporarily close any of its locations for at least a day? Locations closing was kind of split. We had 59% say no and 41% said yes. The biggest yeses were in educational services and entertainment, which are somewhat expected as well. Question five. In the last week, did businesses have a change in the number of paid employees? Okay, so this was kind of split as well. We had 28% said down, 4% were up, and 68% said no, we didn't have a change in the number of paid employees. Keep in mind that this is the first week of the survey covering April 26th through May 2nd. So one of the benefits of releasing the weekly data is we'll be able to look at time series for these particular questions by state and by industry. Question eight, in the last week, did this business shift to the production of other goods and services? We had an overwhelming no here with 93% saying no. The biggest yes was in educational services, which had a 20% change. But this gives us the idea that businesses are not able to easily pivot from one industry and one production model to another. So we've heard, about businesses manufacturing ventilators and shifting their production lines. Well, it's not very easy to do according to the results we're seeing. Question 10, how would you describe the current availability of cash on hand for this business? About 66% of all small businesses say they have less than 2 months of cash on hand, which is somewhat concerning, thinking that we're in week 10 of this activity. Okay. Question 13, has this business requested financial assistance from any of the following? And you could see on the left-hand side, overwhelmingly PPP has about 75% of businesses requesting assistance. And I'll quickly go to the next slide, and you could see, digging a little deeper, the highest request for PPP was in food services and accommodation, with over 85% requesting assistance. And the next, which is, the closing part of that discussion, has this business received financial assistance from any of these programs? And we see that over 38% have received PPP, which is about half of those reporting applying for PPP. Just keep in mind that this is not the total universe of those applicants for PPP as received by the agency providing the assistance, but still tells a story that in the first week, about half of those businesses have received assistance. Finally, question 15 gives us an indication of the future. How much time do you think will pass before this business returns to its normal level of operations? And it's somewhat encouraging to see in the first week that only 6% of the businesses say they will never return to their normal levels of operation. Again, we'll see how that changes as the weeks go by and we have a time series to use. Okay, the schedule, our current plans are to run weekly through the end of June. Week 9 will be mailed on June 21st and close on June 22nd, published on July 2nd. Tomorrow we will be publishing weeks 2 and 3. And I was just told this about an hour ago that we actually released the metro level data. So we're producing data for the 50 largest metropolitan areas. And we're also producing data down to a 3-digit NAICS level. So that is available right now for week 1. It'll be available for weeks 2 and 3 tomorrow. Okay, future. We are currently assessing a potential and the need for a second phase of this. So phase 1, you know, was kind of, we learned some things from phase 1. We had some discussions on the content with our partners, stakeholders who were heavily involved with this. We're now assessing phase 2. These are some of the topic, the content topics that we're considering. And we will continue working with our partners and OMB to keep everyone informed on a second phase of this. Okay, I want to shift gears real quickly to another weekly series we developed as a result of the COVID-19 situation, our business formation statistics. I'll provide a few slides on these. The business formation statistics are an aggregation of administrative records. They're typically published quarterly, but with a few processing changes, we managed to be able to produce them on a weekly basis. And they're available at a state level on a weekly basis. We publish a total business applications number, as well as 3 additional series each Thursday at noon. So the 3 additional series consist of a high propensity business application. These are businesses that through a model have a greater tendency to actually become employer businesses. We have a business applications with planned wages and also a business application from corporations. Okay. Skip to the next. Okay. All right. This is what we've seen over the last several weeks in our business formation series. So definitely seeing a significant drop in applications through all the series. However, the total business application series is almost starting to show a positive gain as of last week. So we'll see if Thursday, if that pushes over the 0% mark. Okay, there's also a tool available for the business application series. It provides data at the state and regional level. And all the data is also downloadable. And finally, we have a new visualization that we recently created, which overlays the weekly unemployment insurance claims with the business formation. So you can see the relationship between the lack of business formations and the claims that are within the state. That's the end of my presentation, and now I'll turn it over to Victoria to talk about the household pulse.
Nick, I think you need to stop sharing so I can share.
I'm getting there.
Okay.
Trying to find it.
I think that if you go down to the PowerPoint it will say stop.
I think he has stopped doing it.
Okay, great.
As Charles, I'm
okay, I think I'm almost there.
Yep, you're good.
Good, okay, great. Well, we're really excited to be here to be talking about the Household Pulse Survey that we put together to measure the social and economic impacts of COVID-19. We really designed this survey so we could deploy quickly and efficiently and collect data on a range of ways in which people's lives were being impacted by the pandemic. And since the environment and circumstances we're operating in are changing so rapidly, we designed this so that we could quickly assess and report on critical issues as fast as possible. We started having conversations about this survey on March 23rd, and we wanted to get into the field as soon as possible. We also worked with partners, our partners in the federal statistical system, so BLS, the National Center for Health Statistics, HUD, the National Center for Education Statistics, Office of Management and Budget, USDA's Economic Research Service. And we are really thinking of this as like a proof of concept to show that the federal statistical system can react quickly to provide data when a pandemic like COVID hits. I'm going to talk a little bit more about the metrics behind or the methodology behind our survey. We decided to use a platform called Qualtrics, which was being used by people in the research side of the house at Census. It already had a FedRAMP moderate authorization, and it had a Census Bureau authority to operate, so we thought we could use it to quickly get the survey going. As Nick said, our National Processing Center was either shutting down or shut down as we were talking about this survey, so we knew we couldn't mail out a letter invitation like we typically do for our household surveys. So we decided that we would use emailing and text to invite people to take the online survey. So this is something pretty new for us at Census. We have an email and phone contact frame. We match that frame to our master address file. Our master address file has all the addresses in the US in it. And we found that the phone frame had about a billion phone address pairs that covered about 88% of addresses in the country. And the email frame contained just under 700 million email address pairs, which covered about 80% of the addresses in the country. And the two frames don't overlap completely, so we wanted to be able to both text and email. We worked very closely with our federal partners to come up with the content. We used questions from existing surveys when we could, but of course we were asking questions about the impact of COVID, so we couldn't always do that. Typically at the Census Bureau, if we're putting in a new question, we do a lot of testing. We didn't have the time to do that, so we did a very rigorous expert review of both the English and Spanish questionnaire and also our contact scripts. The first couple weeks of data collection, we also had an affinity panel test going, which is where people can opt in, and we did some probing around the new questions, particularly on food security and education. And we also did a couple experiments along the way because we're the Census Bureau. One was how to access a Spanish translation, and the other was how best to invite someone to a bilingual survey using email and text. Here's the content. Of course, we have basic demographics. We have a series of questions about employment. So we ask about loss of employment income, expected loss of employment income, if people were working, reasons for not working, if they weren't working, and of course the answer categories for that question has some COVID-related responses. We asked about food security, so we asked about past food sufficiency, current food sufficiency, whether people were getting free meals, where they were getting them from, money spent on groceries, and money spent on prepared food. We also have a series of questions on health. We first ask one's overall health, and then we ask a series of mental health questions. We ask about health insurance, and we also ask about delays in getting healthcare due to COVID. We have a few questions on housing, basic tenure, and then we ask if the person paid their rent and mortgage on time this month and what their confidence about paying the rent and mortgage next month is. And then we have a series of questions on education. So asking about the impact of COVID on how children received education, whether they had access to a computer or a digital device, who provided the device, did they have internet, who paid for the internet, and the hours spent with teachers and hours spent on educational activities. We had a soft launch that led to a full implementation, and this was an interesting learning experience. So on April 23rd, 1 month after we started talking about the survey, we went into the field with the survey, and we call this week 1A. We designed the survey to have a Thursday through Tuesday data collection period so that we could process the data file on Wednesday and send a new sample back out to the contractor on Wednesday to start with data collection on Thursday. That first week, we were only able to send out to one email address per MAF ID. Each MAF ID has up to 5 email addresses, but the first week we were limited to just one. And we were really somewhat disappointed with our response rate. We had about 18,000 responses, and we were expecting quite a bit more. So we went back to the table and we decided we would keep this sample in the field for another week. So we called it week 1B. And what we learned was that the major email providers were sending our email invitations to spam. Our contractor was sending out 100 of thousands of emails at a time from one census address, and they went straight to spam. So we had to work with each of the providers to talk them into not making our emails spam. Luckily, our contractor had a good connection at Verizon and talked to them, and we had someone at Census who could talk to Google for us. That took some time, and we didn't get that resolved until Thursday afternoon of that week. So that week 1B was a Friday through Tuesday data collection. We also were able in week 1B to send out emails to the 4 additional email addresses for each MAF ID. And we implemented a Spanish translation and a bilingual email invitation. For week 2, again, we went out on a Friday, and this time it was because we were starting to text and we needed a unique text number that we could put on our website so people could check to see that it was a legitimate survey, and it took some time to get that number. So we started on a Friday, and week 2 was also the second interview for respondents who had completed the interviews from the first week. For week 3, we have full implementation of text and email, and we went out on Thursday and we closed yesterday at about 6 p.m. To give you some idea of our response rates, for week 1, which is A and B, we sent out about 1.8 million invitations. We got about 63,000 completed interviews and 11,000 partial interviews for about 74,000 total responses. That's approximately a 3.8 response rate. We are expecting a response rate of 4 or 5%, so it's within range. And 15% of the week 1 responses came from sufficient partials. And for the geeks out there, a sufficient partial for us is that when someone completed at least 30% or more of the survey. Week 2 responses, we went out to a slightly smaller sample, just over 1 million. We had about 36,000 completed interviews, about 5,000 partial interviews for just under 42,000 responses. And that response rate was a bit lower at 1.3%. And 13% of these week 2 responses came from sufficient partials. I'm happy to report that we closed out data collection for week 3 last night. And last time I checked, we had 107,000 completed responses. So we'll be doing much better in week 3. And note, week 3 is when we had full implementation of emailing and texting. So we released our data this morning on the experimental data product website. We have data for weeks 1 and 2. We also have static tables for this first data release. They're national level only, and next week we'll put them out for the nation and the states and the 15 largest MSAs. We also have an interactive tool that has national and state data for selected indicators. And we know that our partner agencies are also releasing data. So I think NCHS is releasing data perhaps today. This is just to give you an example of what our interactive tool looks like. We are looking at these indicators over here on the left: loss in employment income, expected loss in employment income, food scarcity, delayed medical care, housing insecurity, and educational attainment. This is a screenshot, but if you scroll over the states, you can see the states' responses. For this week only, we have a static chart on the right-hand side that just shows week 1 and week 2 totals for those indicators. And you have the state data below, and you can toggle between the weeks. and we will keep improving this as we go. I wanted to show you just a couple of the data items. This slide is looking at the percent of households that had at least one person who lost employment income since March 13th. So 46.7% of adults lived in a household where at least one person lost some income since March 13th. That's on the left-hand side. On the right-hand side is expected loss of employment income in the next 4 weeks. So about 38.5% of adults that are living in a household where they think somebody will lose employment income in the next 4 weeks. As I said, we asked several questions about mental health. This one is about the graph on the left-hand side is about feeling anxious. The one on the right-hand side is feelings of worry. And you can see that over half of respondents felt anxious either several days or more and also had feelings of worry for several days or more. And this graph is about food sufficiency. You could see this is food sufficiency on the left prior to March 13th, about 70% of households had enough of the food and the kinds they wanted. If you look on the right-hand side, it's food sufficiency in the last 7 days, and that drops to about 57.3% who had enough and the kinds of food that they wanted. Also, the proportion of having enough but not the kinds of food they wanted went up, and obviously there's certain people that don't have enough food, so sometimes not enough food. So that is my very super quick presentation. Here's where you can find all of the data. We have a household survey main page. We have a data tool. We've got the data tables. We've got technical documentation. And then we also have a survey respondent overview. And that's all for me. And I'm going to turn it over to Danny, I think. But first, I have to stop presenting, I believe.
Thank you very much, Vicki and Nick and Ron. Yeah, so we invited Danny Goroff to join this conversation because over the last several years, he's been very active in thinking about how do we make our economic statistics better and creatively thinking about how to build a consensus. So we asked Danny to talk a little bit about putting these new experimental data into some context. And he has apparently mastered slide sharing. So, Danny, the floor is yours.
Amazing group. So I'm Daniel Goroff. I'm from the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation. The first thing I have to say is that the opinions that I express here today are not necessarily those of the Sloan Foundation or of any other institution I might be affiliated with, but they should be. So like most of you, I pray every day for the people who are working on vaccines. But once you get past the biomedicine and some very basic public health considerations, all of our other COVID challenges are social, behavioral, and economic. And so we really need tools. And what kinds of tools? Well, I would say that surveys really are part of the research infrastructure, and that they're very much like telescopes or other large laboratories, but these are our telescopes for the social, behavioral, and economic sciences. And I just wanna say that the small business pulse and the household pulse that we've heard about have really risen to the top of my list of critical infrastructure like this. And it's really just a brilliant and extraordinary achievement for the whole federal statistical system. Now, some of you may know it's a little bit of an exaggeration to call it a system. It's made up of many different pieces, and it's known really more for a dedication to process and to accuracy than it is under normal circumstances for speed or cooperation or agility. So this is really a remarkable achievement, and it just shows, excuse me, it shows what really government agencies and very dedicated government workers can accomplish. And I would argue something that only the government can do. My one quibble is with the icon. We've seen this experimental data icon a few times, and it seems to be a microscope. I think it should really be a macroscope. I'll take the rainbow and looking towards what we can see after the storm, but I think that a better kind of an icon would have a little bit more of a celebration and a little bit more of a salute, because I'll take any good news I can get these days whenever anybody can accomplish something. So that's my addition to the icon. I did want to mention just a few of my other favorite surveys that are part of the research and infrastructure. Several of them here are funded by NSF, a few by NIH. But just to emphasize that these are grand, slow, and very venerable kinds of institutions. The Longitudinal Employer and Household Dynamics, the LEHD, is something that the Sloan Foundation put a lot of time and effort into standing up before it was taken over by the federal government. And that just took many, many, many years. So the idea of being able to do something like this in a few weeks is, as I say, totally extraordinary. Let me just say a word about why some of these are my favorite surveys. Some of this is obvious, and we've already heard about having useful and unambiguous questions in the survey design. Obviously, the trend tracking, having some consistency over time, the way this survey will. I also very much appreciate robust reporting, where there are some error bars and some caution about causality. After all, it's worth appreciating when people don't misrepresent the findings. Surveys like this, after all, are not experiments, and drawing correlations is something that you can do very easily. Coming up with causal inferences is a lot harder, and I'll just say two more words about that, which are vitamin D. So that's on the robust reporting, but let me spend a moment on the sampling strategy, because that's really what sets all of this apart. Having a really representative probability sample of a well-defined target population that's based on a really amazing sampling frame, that's really terrific. And not everyone can do that. In fact, really only the Feds can have access to this kind of detail. And certainly to be able to put it together so quickly, it's really quite remarkable. So this is something that really only the federal government, really using all the kinds of data, the frames that have been developed by the Census Bureau, only they can do that right now. Personally, I would like to argue that having more of that capability of computing weights available to others might be an element of the National Secure Data Service, if that comes into being. It's been called for by Congress, and we'll see. But that's a very interesting kind of work. I would be remiss if I don't mention just a few of the kinds of emphasis topics that the Sloan Foundation has had. We've been very interested in trying to develop sustainable business models for these surveys. It's not so easy. Thank goodness that OMB was able to come up with the funding for this. We've been very interested in privacy and trust. I'll mention work on open differential privacy, and just want to emphasize that the Census Bureau in particular has been a very, very responsible steward of individual and sensitive data, and has been very careful about implementing the kinds of privacy protection that we expect these days. We're very interested in administrative data and how that can be used to bring survey techniques into the 21st century. We also helped fund the COVID-19 impact survey, which was a forerunner to the official survey from the Census Bureau and the Federal Statistical System that we heard about today. And we've also worked on setting up something called the COVID-19 Survey Archive. And this is a joint work with the NSF and the National Academy of Sciences, and it's part of a whole larger effort called SHAN, and that stands for the Societal Experts Action Network. And the idea is to provide, to start with questions that are posed by decision makers, mayors, governors, people who have really urgent decisions to make, and to produce rapid expert consultations that are based both on the literature for social, behavioral, and economic sciences, but also on the very latest survey data, like the data that we've been hearing about. And one of the elements of this Sean network is an archive that we've put together that I would recommend to you that features a weekly summary of all the kinds of probability-based, high-quality statistics that are being produced these days. That is meant to soon include, their work underway to include the pulse data that we heard about today. It has a summary, as I said, that comes out every week of lots of different surveys. You can compare and contrast who's finding what about how many people say they would take a vaccine if it were found tomorrow. Started out at 25% who said they would not. And then another survey recently showed that a third of the people said that they absolutely would not take a vaccine if it were available. So you can read about these kinds of trends. It also has an archive that's searchable. So for those of you who love looking up all different survey results, you can look up here the word stress and find all of the cases where, again, reputable surveys have asked questions with the word stress in the query, and find also the results and a certain amount of documentation. So that's another resource for people who are interested in these sorts of questions. And let me just close by echoing what was said before. The census has been doing amazing work, and especially while busy with just a few other responsibilities that they might have. And that makes the accomplishment here even more impressive. There are many reasons for filling out your census form that we know about, the dollars that have to flow and reapportionment and so on. But I just want to underscore that you should fill out your census form because we really, really need these terrific and amazing and great sampling frames. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Danny. And now we're going to bring everybody together. I've got a number of questions from our audience. If you have a question, you can email it to events@brookings.edu or put it on Twitter at hashtag COVID-19 economy. The questions really come in two different baskets. Some people are interested in the substance, and a surprisingly large number of people are interested in the details of how you did this and what we learned from this. So if we could unmute everybody. Tori, I'd like to, a couple people, well, there was one thing you didn't talk about. I appreciate after we beat you over the head and said keep your presentation to 15 minutes that you had to make some choices. But you asked an interesting question about housing security, whether people were having trouble paying their rent or mortgage on time or expected to have a problem in the next month. And I wondered if you have those results handy, if you could just share those first.
I think I showed them in my presentation, yes?
I'm not sure you did, but...
I didn't. I probably... someone can email them to me.
Okay. I have the very nice summary that the Census Bureau did. So why don't you unshare your screen?
Okay.
So what you found was that about 11% of adults said they had trouble paying their rent or a mortgage on time. Another 3% said they deferred payments. And when asked about the likelihood of being able to pay next month's rent or mortgage on time, 21% reported only slight or no confidence in being able to do that. So one out of five people is worried about paying their mortgage or rent on time. I found that a little bit unnerving. When the questions like these, until you have a number of weeks of results, we won't really have any sense of how they compare to what the world was like 3 months ago. Is that right?
That's correct. I think we do. I don't think that we ask that type of question on either the CPS or the ACS. So you're right. That is something that we've been thinking about ourselves. What do we compare? What was normal?
Right. I mean, it struck me that over time, we'll see an interesting trend here, whether things are getting better or worse,
right,
even if the level is not we don't quite know what to make of the level.
Right.
Somebody asked how to look at the Pulse survey questions on employment income relative to the standard unemployment rate that we get every month. So are they just different questions?
They're different questions, definitely. It's not an employment rate at all. It is, did you lose employment income or did someone in your household lose employment income? So clearly different from what the unemployment questions are on the CPS. Mm-hmm. And we were very specific. We didn't want to repeat the questions that were on the CPS.
And there may be, I don't know enough about these surveys. This may not be an easy question to answer. It may be simple, but someone asked, why did you have to go do another survey? Why couldn't you piggyback on the CPS or the ACS, the surveys that are already in the field?
So when we first started talking, we actually discussed that. The ACS is a mandatory survey, and so it's very hard to add content to it. And the CPS, of course, is the survey that collects the unemployment rate. We did add questions to the May CPS, but we wanted to get out there and be quick. The CPS takes a while, and it's also, we don't like to rock the boat because it's measuring the unemployment rate. So that's why we chose, I think Ron remembers us, we had this conversation. I said, let's just start a whole new survey. It will be easier than trying to get it on that surveys that exist already.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think one of the other things we wanted to accomplish was week to week variations.
Yes, exactly.
Especially at the beginning, this was really a fast moving situation that we had. And even the CPS is a monthly survey that comes out with a pretty significant lag. If you want to provide timely information, this was really the only way we could go.
Right.
And I'll just add that some of the indicators on the economic side usually hit the large companies. They're not really intended for the small businesses, and they're relatively small samples. So this covers a much broader group of small businesses.
Nick, somebody asked why on the list of financial assistance that you might get from the government, you don't include the employee retention tax credit.
Yes, we've received that question already, just when we released the data. So the honest answer is that we were not really aware of that program. And, our partners were not aware of it, and we didn't include it. So that's definitely something we'll consider for a phase two.
See, now, so as I understand it, you have an email address on a lot of businesses, right?
Correct.
And so, they're based on the 2017 economic census, is that right?
That is basically where we're getting them. If we get updates through the other surveys, we'll try to incorporate those. And that's what we did also. We looked to see if there were updated email addresses based on some of our annual programs. But yes, for the most part, it is the 2017 economic census. And there was a registration process for the economic census. So they were required to provide a valid email through that process.
But does that mean you'll miss relatively new businesses?
Well, the register is updated often, but not with email addresses. So it could mean that, but we had an over 96% delivery rate. Which means a very small amount of these emails bounce back. Mm-hmm. And we saw that many of them were opened. So our response rate through the second week was over 25%. So that's very encouraging as far as the survey reaching who we're intending it to reach.
A lot of people seem to be interested in more statistical information, standard errors and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. Do you guys intend to provide more than you have already? Vicki, do you want to start?
Yeah, sure. Next week we'll be putting out the microdata files, and it will have the replicate weights so people can calculate standard errors. And I believe we have standard errors in our static tables that we released today, and we will continue to do that. I don't know if we're going to put them in the interactive tool, but of course we're the Census Bureau. We always want to have standard errors around our estimates. So of course we're doing that.
Okay, that's great. Someone asked about the microdata. So at least one person out there is happy if he or she is listening.
It's not coming out until next week though. So they have to wait a week for that.
I'm tempted to say that I can't get anything done in Brookings in the speed at which you're working at the Census Bureau. So I won't be criticizing you about speed. Tori, I wonder if you could just explain a little bit more about how you go about finding people and reaching them. You mentioned text and email, and if you have an address that's linked to an email, do you actually know that the person is at the address that you have? How does this all work?
Well, so we have the frame, and we've matched what we think are good emails to addresses. But think about my address. You have my email, you have my husband's email, you have my son's email. They could all be in our contact frame. And what we're doing is we're cycling through those emails as we go throughout the week. So we'll send something to, say, Bob Sachs, my husband, and he doesn't respond, then we'll get an email to Tori Velkoff. And it will. So we're cycling through the emails that we have, and the same for the text. So, and it's true that you could have an email, and we find there's a few people, or I'm thinking it was 1,000 in the first week, that they responded, but when they gave us their address, it was not the address that we thought it was. So there's a little bit of movement.
So what do you do in that case?
In that case, we actually, I think that we move them to where their new address is, and wait them up with the waits for that, where they're living, not the address that we thought they were living at.
And what is the texting about? Is the texting to reach people for whom you have a phone number but not an email, or what?
Yes. So that's an excellent question. We've been thinking about using text to invite people in to do our surveys for some time. And it is both for people who we don't have an email, or for people in that first week, if we ask them if they would prefer us to contact them via text, then we definitely sent them a text the second week to invite them to do the survey.
I see. And how do you make sure that you're getting a representative set of Americans and not just people who happen to be on their email all the time?
Well, yeah. So we have, obviously, we control to population totals at the national and state level. And we also have a control in there for educational attainment, because we noticed that we were, our respondents are slightly more educated than the American public. So we're trying to deal with that with our controls. You know, obviously, when you have a response rate of 5%, it's not the same as the response rate of what we're used to, 85-90%. But we're using our population controls to deal with that. Mm-hmm. And we actually have coverage ratios on our website right now, so you can see how much we're weighting up or down.
So just so lay listeners can understand, you do all these surveys and then you discover that you have a disproportionate number of people who have college degrees. So you adjust the data so that you're reflecting the opinion of everybody, right?
Yes.
Danny, I don't, if you have a question, please chime in. There's no, we can be very open. Ron, I'm just curious a little bit about, two things. One is, what should I take away as a consumer of this when you have experimental all over it? Does that mean you don't really believe it? And secondly, I'm kind of interested in how you pulled this off bureaucratically. How did this get initiated, and what were the challenges you faced?
So first of all, I mean, the experimental data products are really meant to get stuff out sooner as opposed to later, so that users can evaluate and help us improve the data so that they then later become, you know, part of the standard, you know, release schedule of the Census Bureau. Clearly, you know, obviously a brand new survey with a 5% response rate, it's not going to get the same imprimatur from the Census Bureau as the CPS or the ACS, right? So, you know, this is an attempt to do something to get, you know, good, solid, reasonably, carefully constructed information that maybe doesn't have all of the bells and whistles from a quality perspective that some of our baseline surveys do, but get it in the hands of people, see what they find useful and what they find objectionable about them, and can we then improve them over time? I think this is just trying to be more nimble and get data in people's hands quicker is the main thing that we're trying to do with the experimental data series. you know, the bureaucratic, you know, we had to go through the same Paperwork Reduction Act activities with the Office of Management and Budget that we normally do. And so it wasn't just our staff that had to work extra hours for this. It was them as well. And so we really appreciate their dedication and working after hours and on the weekends to help us get what we all collectively, I think, thought were important surveys for the country to get out into the field. And so, you know, obviously, you know, going forward, you know, to do these, you know, as a sort of an ongoing thing in times of crisis, you know, ways that we could streamline that process would be something that I think we should look into. And, you know, we're thinking that we could stand sort of pull surveys like this up, you know, on a much more localized basis in the case of, say, a hurricane in South Florida or something like that, where you really wanted to get some timely information about what people are doing, you know, the folks that were impacted. So, you know, we think that this is a nice model. We'd like to continue it. But obviously anything that we can do to lower the cost of doing so would help a lot.
And correct me if I'm wrong, but so I see a lot of surveys reported in the press. Some of them are of the quality that is on the Sean site that Danny mentioned. Some of them are a little frightening given when you see that they surveyed 14 people who have the last name beginning with the letter S. Compared to what is out there, this is a large number of people you're reaching compared to the stuff that you see ordinarily, right?
Yep.
Yeah. I mean, when we had that response rate of 18,000 and we were very disappointed, I kept saying, but 18,000 is a lot of people. And now for week three, we have 107,000 people that responded to this survey. Right. I just wanted to add to what Ron said.
Please.
The fact that these were experimental really gave us the opportunity to try new things and make tweaks as we went along. And I think that was really a new way of thinking for us at the Census Bureau to be like, oh, well, that's not working. What can we change the script? Can we try this? And it seems to be paying off now.
So I think one quick thing is, you know, even when these go away, some of the things that we've learned about using emails and text messaging will probably migrate to some of our more baseline surveys. So I think this was a lot of valuable learning happened in this over and above just, you know, doing the pulse surveys.
Yeah, so, and I'll just add to that real quickly is that we've used email very sparingly for some of our monthly indicators. I hope this is a signal to use it more broadly. It is also definitely a cost saver, you know, to email individuals and businesses rather than sending out hundreds of thousands of pieces of paper.
Yeah, no, I see this as a really huge step forward in what all kinds of surveys can do to try to reach people and to get a representative sample in a less expensive way than knocking on doors or other methods. And to the point about a representative sample, I have to say that I saw a very large survey that was done recently. I won't name the universities that were involved with this, but it was several of the most prestigious universities from around the world. And they wanted to know what was happening with COVID and how it was impacting people. And they put something up on the web and they just invited people to answer these questions. And they were thoughtful about it to the extent of translating the questions into many different languages and so on. But I realized that you could take this survey as many times as you want. If you care to make a bot, you could probably answer it, you know, thousands and thousands of times. And so the idea that this was in any sense representative of the populations in the countries that they were looking at, let alone the world, is really very far-fetched. And so the point is that it's not just the numbers. People sometimes talk these days as if the only problem ever in statistics was sample size. And now that we have big data, we got that one covered. So the sample size is certainly important, and this is certainly an impressive sample size to be sure. But it's also getting a representative sample that's so important, and having those statistical frames that the federal statistical system has really makes all the difference.
Mm-hmm. I just want to, I think we covered this, but the question came up again, so I want to make sure we're clear. You are going to release microdata files on both the small business and the household surveys for people to look at and produce custom tables and stuff. Is that correct?
Correct.
Yeah. Yes.
And so, Nick, I'm just curious, when you looked at the results from the small business survey, was there, what leaped out at you as being particularly interesting or maybe even surprising, if anything?
Well, I think most of the results were kind of in line with our expectations. When we put out our first release last Thursday, we did a briefing the day before for Ron and some representatives at the Small Business Administration. And some of the results we were seeing on the financial assistance were a little concerning to us, in the sense that we saw about 75% of businesses requesting PPP assistance, and we saw only about 38% receiving. And we had the reps there from SBA, and they confirmed, and we looked at it geographically, and they said that was in line with their expectations as well. So I think for the most part, it was in line with our expectations. Some of the results were, you know, not too encouraging. But I think, you know, we'll see a better picture over time. I think what's been mentioned here is this time series will add a lot of value to what we're seeing in week one.
And do you think that it'll be meaningful if we look, if we have 4 or 5 weeks of data, to look at, compare different states and how they're doing?
Oh, absolutely. I think that's a great comparison right now. You could see definitely a distinction between between geographic areas. I think it will be, you know, I haven't had the opportunity to look at the metro data, but I think if you look at some of the metro data in the middle of the country versus on the coasts, there is definitely distinctions there to be made.
Mm-hmm. I'm just going to, I'm getting some warning that my internet is unstable, so I'm just going to turn off the camera until that passes.
Yeah, I think we're getting the same message. I am, at least.
Tori, someone asked a broad question. You kind of touched on this, but I'll ask it the way that it was asked. What stood out to you in the Household Pulse survey of all the interesting things you found there?
I think the mental health questions were disturbing, but kind of reassuring at the same time, that people, you know, we're all a little anxious and worried, and that we are measuring that seems to be consistent with how people's lives are. So that stood out. And also the loss of employment income was, you know, resonated with us. When we saw those numbers, we were very surprised.
So when you talked about doing the survey at the Census Bureau, and you say you want to ask people questions about anxiety and depression and stuff, does everybody nod and say that's a great idea, or is that like cause blood pressures to go up?
Well, so we worked very closely with the National Center for Health Statistics, and those questions came from the National Center for Health Statistics. And we let each agency give us the questions that they thought were most relevant and most important. Those questions have been tested on, I think, the NHIS. So they're well-tested questions. And, you know, I think people are feeling anxious and worried right now. Things are happening that we're not used to. So it's not a Census Bureau question. It's an NCHS question. And I didn't have any heartburn at all about putting it on the survey.
And how did you, what have you learned? What lessons would you take away from this whole process, good or bad?
Well, we've learned a lot of things. Texting, for example. We sent our emails out starting at around 2 a.m. so they would be at the top of people's email boxes in the morning. However, for texting, you can't text in the middle of the night, particularly from a government survey, right? You don't want to text on your cell phone. So we had to text later in the day. So that was one lesson we learned. To text, you also, to get the survey invitation into the text, you have to have a very short message. So we got very creative about inviting people into a survey on a text. So I think just using texting and emailing since we haven't done that on our surveys, it's useful. And I've already started talking to the American Community Survey about what we're learning about texting, because I know they've been looking into it for a while.
Hmm. Ron, is there anything you think we should touch on that we haven't?
No, I think we've covered it. I think, you know, Danny's point about the frames is an important one, and maybe I'll just put it differently here. I don't think we're pretending that these surveys are representative either, but we know at least some of the ways that they aren't representative because we link them back to the frames from which they were constructed. That's not, you know, right, to tell you everything. We don't have every useful piece of variation measured in the frames. Otherwise, we would just compute all our statistics from the frames. But the notion that you got to have something to sort of gauge how, you know, representative this is, because what we don't know about these surveys right now is the different types of behavioral things when a respondent gets them vis-a-vis some of our traditional methodologies. And so, you know, we'll learn a lot about that over time. And as we extend some of these contact methods to other surveys, we'll be able to learn more and then be able to do contact strategies that ensure that we get a representative, a more representative cross-section of the population.
And I'm thinking just some of this stuff we'll be able to benchmark eventually, like we'll know how many businesses applied for the PPP or how many people suffered a loss of employment income, and some we'll never quite be able to benchmark because of the nature of the question, right?
I think that that's right. Obviously, we'll have some other administrative sources that we'll be able to link to, both from programs that are touching households and businesses that are affected by the pandemic, but also from just our standard baseline activities as well. So I think that, you know, this is what we can do to get information in people's hands now. But people are going to be looking at these data and other data sort of mashed up, if you will, for years to come. And we'll learn a lot from those exercises as well.
Right. Nick, somebody's asking about the Fed's Main Street Lending Program and whether that'll be on your list. As I recall, your survey is for businesses of less than 500 employees, right?
Correct.
Right?
Yeah. That's the broad definition of a small business.
Right. And so is the Fed's Main Street Lending Program one that you would put on your list, or is that mostly for businesses that are slightly larger?
Yeah, I am not the expert on those types of questions. We will note it, and the Federal Reserve was one of our partners in this effort. So we will note it, and as we reach out to them, we'll bring that up as well.
Okay. Well, I want to thank all of you for your time, and of course, thank the Census Bureau for your hard work, particularly in a time when all of us are being asked to work at home, or many of us. Both Vicki and Nick have said, the survey results are up. It's pretty easy to find on the census site. And if you just Google census experimental surveys, these come up. And Danny gave the URL for this interesting Sean compendium of all those things. And if you have any questions that we didn't get to, please email us and we'll try and get you the answers in some fashion. And in the meantime, keep up the good work and stay safe. Thank you all.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.